Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Tom, are you team, hey, chef, do the work for me, or are you team, give me a bib?
Team, give me a bib, baby. You're talking to a New Englander. Give me that 1.5 pound red lobster, steam that puppy, and then work it. It's one of my favorite summertime activities. I like to shuck my own oysters, but kind of like Shota, I might not be the best at it.
Nah, I'm paying you. You do the work.
That's what the money is for.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, we're down to the final three. We're on the Oregon coast. And incidentally, yeah, Tom, come on. I'm paying for this. It's too much work. It's why I don't order crab more often, because I just am not doing manual labor at dinner.
No, see, I like the beauty of it. I feel like I'm being in touch with nature a little bit more when you have the lobster on the plate and you can crack it open. The only thing I will say here, Kevin, one of my biggest pet peeves is when you get like a pasta dish and the shrimp is on there with the tail. I'm done. I hate the tail on a shrimp in an already prepared dish. I get it on a shrimp cocktail because it's used as a handle. If you're going to dip the shrimp into the sauce, I understand the purpose of the tail being on the shrimp. But if it's already in the dish, if it's already immersed in the risotto or the pasta, there's no purpose in having the tail in there. What do you think about that?
I'm with you there. In fact, there's this great like salt and pepper shrimp at the Chinese restaurant we love most here in Los Angeles. And, you know, they, like many, leave the tail on. And now, in that case, it's fried enough that you actually can eat the shell. Yeah, but I'm always with you. Now, I think there's probably an answer for this. And I know chefs, like the actual flavor you get from shell is just so lovely that maybe the case is that you want to leave that on as long as possible. And also when it comes out, do you want to start detailing shrimp when it's piping hot? So that could be the answer. But yeah, my thing is also like if you get pasta with clams, like I don't want to start opening clams like when I'm dealing with pasta. You know, like I'm with you. Like once I'm in a bowl of pasta, I don't need to reach in there. Like that's a little much. Like, you know. But yeah, that was though a lot of crab in this episode, a lot of clams. We are down to three, Shota, Gabe, and Dawn. We sort of handicapped it last week. I think it is a toss-up. And they start at 5 in the morning because that is low tide, and that is when you have to go put those crazy little galoshes on or whatever they are. And I've just never clammed and oystered in my life. Like, I have to admit, this is totally new territory for me. And you're going out and you're looking at gaper clams. You're looking at butter clams, both native to the Oregon coast. Oregon coast just produces some great freaking seafood, by the way. So there they are at the crack of dawn, those crazy little boots and their shovels.
You know, I kind of feel bad for Brooke. I feel like she's been thrown the short end of the stick all season here. She has to do the 5 a.m. in the rain, go out and clamming. And like a couple episodes ago, she didn't have some of the ingredients on a plate. And then there was the French in the dark preparing the dish.
Oh, that's right. She was enlisted for a quick fire. Now she's doing manual labor.
Yeah, like, come on. Like, poor Brooke this season.
I know. Everybody else gets to, like, put on a flower dress and just show up for dinner. And she's got to do all this work.
But she seemed very knowledgeable of the task. So it seemed like she actually might have volunteered to be the clamor out there, to go out at the crack of dawn. No pun intended, dawn out there at the crack of dawn, going out and doing some clamming. I love fishing. I like shrimping. So like when I go out to Oak Island, where my family goes every summer, I'll get the casting net and I'll go get my shrimp. Instead of buying the shrimp at the store for the bait, I'll go out into this marshy area with a casting net. Allison's learned how to do it. It's fun to catch your own bait. So you catch the minnows, you catch the shrimp.
Let me understand something. Not only are you going to go drift around with a stick in the water for hours, you actually are going to do the stick in the water so you can get the thing to put the thing on the bottom of the stick on the water?
Yeah, so you go to like a creek, right? You go to a creek, oh, and Lord. Sometimes you get crabs too. You take a casting net, and it's got all these weights around this this circular net, and then you toss it into the water, and you reel it in, and you get like little minnows, maybe some shrimp popping around, and you put them in a bucket. Then you take the bubbler machine, and you put it in the bucket so that the shrimp stay alive, and then you take it into the car. You take the car to the pier, and then you get a six-pack of beer, and you sit at the pier, and you put the shrimp on the line, on the hook, and then you toss the you cast out the fishing pole, and it goes into the water, and then you sit there for a long time hoping to catch food for a meal later that day. Sometimes it doesn't happen. So that's my introduction into clamming. I've never done clamming.
I gotta tell you something, Tom.
But I'd imagine, given the fact that I like to go shrimping and minnowing and casting nets and all this stuff, I feel like I'd really dig it.
Jews ain't doing that thing, and gays certainly ain't doing that thing, and I ain't doing that thing.
I like it. Do you like hiking and camping out?
Yes, I like hiking. No, I do camp.
Okay.
A little bit. Well, I camp if, like, someone carries the stuff and sets it up and everything. I glamp.
That's not camping. You glamp.
I'm not hauling anything on my back for the rest of my life. I'm done with that.
Wait, no, you go to Mongolia and you're living by yourself.
And there's a Jeep and there's a 4x4. No, I enjoy the solitude of that. I understand the sort of there's a certain peace and tranquility that comes with that activity you just described for some reason. I mean, personally, I go and get a table for two overlooking the water, and there are other people, they bring me the food, and that's it. I mean, I don't hunt either.
So you're like, you know what, guys, I'm giving you the quick fire. I'm going to sleep in this morning.
I would. I mean, there's no, honestly, and they're throwing $10,000 down on the thing. I mean, I'm up early, and that's the one thing. I could see myself doing the clam oyster thing. Right. I could see myself digging around for half an hour. That I could see myself doing.
In the cold rain, though?
Not in the cold rain. I mean, that is the problem with the Oregon coast. It is so frequently kind of chilly and dreary. And you're in that poncho.
It seemed awful weather. Couldn't they postpone it a day? couldn't they post? Maybe it's not even worth postponing because the next day is probably going to be the same forecast. But it looked miserably cold and wet and dreary out there.
No, it was funny. I lived in Seattle for about 8 months when I was 20. And it was I got there on Memorial Day and it was just gorgeous for it was gorgeous for 3 months. Every single day it was 78 degrees and sunny and the light out until 9 p.m. And then I remember there was this week in early October. And I'm walking and getting my coffee and this like mist is hitting me at 25 miles per hour. The sky is so low. I feel like I could touch it. And it was just like, welcome to Seattle. And for the next 7 weeks, it was like that 24 hours a day. And it was just this moment it turned from this Pacific Northwest summer paradise to just the eighth circle of hell. And that's what this looked like.
I kind of feel like Dawn might be the favorite in terms of powering through the elements. I feel like an Olympian, who cares? Like pain and weather conditions, I'm good. I'm feeling like Gabe being the Texan that he is, being in cold weather, rainy. I don't think he's probably been exposed to these sort of elements. Shota.
He very cleverly said to Gabe, you know, you dig and I'll just like reach down and get them, which I thought was just kind of my position on this.
I would be the digger and you would just be the collector.
Yeah, that's me. I'll collect.
Shota actually goes clamming, so he feels like he has an advantage in this one. There's some gaper clams, which have to be, Kevin, the ugliest thing I have ever seen.
They look like an organ in your body.
Yeah, and it just it doesn't look appetizing at all. So I wouldn't know the first thing how to clean that or to butcher it. Like I'm like Don. I don't know what
you
I'm doing.
Butcher
with
a thing. Clam? What do you do to a clam? As if there isn't enough here. Shucking oysters and getting those clams open with that little knife that I almost kill myself on when I've done it a few times. You kind of shimmy it. And
I got scars.
Get in the crevice.
I got scars.
Yeah, man. It's just like, it's not fun. But you're right. Shota, Japanese cooking frequently has clams. You see them like a really deep, like rich miso soup. And yeah, I had Shota as the favorite on this one. You know, Dawn says she obviously works with crustaceans a lot because she is a Houston-based chef, but there's not a lot of clams. And I mean, there's some oysters in the Gulf. They're mostly in the Alabama area. But she said, you know, she's pretty much a novice to the clam business.
I didn't see exactly how Shota cut himself, whether it was a knife or whether it was opening up the clams. Did you see?
I had the same question, which is, you know, obviously the shells can have, you know, these kind of sharp points and the edge can be very sharp. But was it a utensil that got him, or was it the actual clam? I have no idea. And they didn't really play it up much. I mean, that was bloody. And usually, you know, if it bleeds, it leads on Top Chef, but they didn't do that.
Yeah, he did the little one-handed cooking there at the end where he didn't have his left hand and he was still manning the stove. And he produces sake yuzu butter clams with an onion. And it didn't look like a finished dish. I almost felt like he might have missed something or didn't get everything that he wanted onto the plate. Don does the clam bisque with apple. And Gabe hits us with the sopa de mariscos with the gaper clams. In the elements, when it's raining outside, it looked miserable. I thought these were three pretty good quick-fire dishes, considering the circumstances.
Yeah, I figured Dawn might have a problem just because a bisque tends to underemphasize in some other, except in some rare cases, the protein, whereas, you know, Gabe's sopa kind of really highlighted it. And, you know, it didn't look like they were sort of chunky. It's like, you know, there's something more disappointing with a chowder than you really don't actually get any clams. It's like, it's a lot of potato and filler and oh yeah, there's a small clam. But unfortunately, Dawn's looked a little bit like it was in that ilk. And then Shota, I love butter yuzu sake soy. Like it is such a beautiful combination because it is truly like, you know, the richness and the citrusy and sort of the, you have this like nice sharp
umami
kind of
then
sharpness
too,
yeah, yeah. Of the sake and soy has salt and it's just such a great combo. And Shota loves him some pickled onion, doesn't he? He is Mr. Pickled Onion. You know, that duck dish he did at the beginning of the season, that was sort of the beautiful little accompaniment. And by the way, you know, who's been pickling some onions and shallots over in his house? I have, Tom.
Yeah.
I have found that this is one of my favorite Shota contributions of the season is I have found it such a lovely little just punctuation mark on any dish. So I have now have this mason jar in the fridge where I kind of keep, you know, some rings of onions and shallots and just kind of if I do them too long, I lose like that nice red on the onion, which is the only problem. But yeah, I'm all about the pickled onion. So thank you, Shota, for introducing me to this little thing that I put on all my dishes.
Enough of the Shota love, Kevin. I get it. You got him on the number one pick and you traded up to get him. Like, I get it, Kevin. Okay, enough. Maybe I'm a little bitter here. But how about those umbrellas? You like those umbrellas on the little clear umbrellas that they all had at the outside of the quickfire? Did you notice that?
No, I didn't notice that.
They all were like outside and they had to do the whole like quickfire judges table. And they're all just, you know, just hanging out with these umbrellas. And I'm trying to think of, you know, how many umbrellas did they have on set? And did they go for like different style umbrellas? These were like clear umbrellas. So I guess you could see everything in the background. So not the best.
That was my other experience of living in Seattle, like once it got to be rainy and even visiting Portland, is I'm always amazed at how the residents act like it's not raining. Like, I mean, they don't speed up their walk in the parking lot. Like, they don't, like, it's just kind of part, they are truly fish in water. And that was always weird to me. Like, because even in the Southeast, you know, you live there, you get these like violent thunderstorms and, hey, it's raining, right? And even though it rains a lot in the Southeast in terms of just inches, in the Pacific Northwest, they act like it is not raining. Like you're not all standing around outside in a line in the rain. And it's just, it's something else that kind of amused me. And I just never got it, which is they just act like it's not raining.
Brooke, again, has to stand out there in the rain with an umbrella. And it just seems like, man, poor Brooke, poor Brooke Williamson.
All right, Brooke, out of these three dishes, which one made us happy as a clam?
There was one person who showcased cookery of the clam a little bit better than the others. And that person is Gabe.
Yeah. Finally!
Congratulations!
It only took 13 weeks.
I finally won a quick fire challenge. It's allowing me to leave on a high note and a lot of momentum going into these final challenges.
Gabe finally gets the quick fire off the schneid. He is someone who it was looking like a Brian Voltaggio to get his first quick fire here. Big, 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 big contribution for Team Haberstrom. More on that later. And then here we go. Elimination challenge, Kevin. Nina Compton, one of my favorite people in the Top Chef universe. And also Kwame showing up. James Beard theme. I got a little of the history on James Beard. I didn't really know a lot of that. So I appreciated the little history lesson on James Beard.
The West is kind of really interesting for that. I mean, we also got Alice Waters. And I don't think people realize like how influential Chez Panisse has been. Because, you know, it was California cooking. And typically, I mean, I think to a great extent, kind of restauranting was always an East Coast thing. Like, you know, there was always a big thing in Los Angeles for years that like we weren't included in as a Michelin city. San Francisco a bit more because it's kind of an older city. But, you know, she opens in Berkeley this like incredible restaurant in this arts and crafts style house. And it just kind of essentially, and they're not wrong. Like she, I don't say created farm to table. People have obviously been eating farm to table for centuries, but it really kind of in terms of elevated farm to table cooking, it's ground zero. Like so many of these places we go to now, right? Or like if you ever been to a restaurant in a cute little house, you know, that wasn't something that people did, right? They didn't have like a really nice, you know, premium restaurant in something that looks like, you know, someone's house. And so the coziness of California cuisine, I mean, she's basically like a huge forerunner. It was really cool to see her because I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong and a listener can correct me, I don't feel like we've kind of done a lot of Alice Waters, although she might have been on an earlier season, but my memory escapes me.
Yeah, Tom brings her on the Zoom to basically give a little pep talk, to the crew. I was expecting some sort of twist like they were. When Tom shows up into the kitchen, you're always like, oh, here comes a Tom curveball, right?
Right.
And there wasn't really that at all. It was just, here's Alice Waters, my pal. And she just gives the tip of like, hey, you really need to have the crab flavor come through, the Dungeness crab. They're going to do a cold dish. They have 2 hours to prepare the cold dish. And then an hour on top of that to prepare the hot dish, which – as an elimination challenge goes, I like to see the two different strategies here. You're preparing two different dishes. And Kevin, they go out on the boats and it's pouring rain again. You know how rainy it was is when the lenses are just fogged up. The lenses on the cameras are fogged up and it's essentially just an absolute downpour. It doesn't seem like all that fun. I'd imagine you're probably getting a little sick because they were up early and they're probably, you know, I don't know. It didn't seem like this was a very enjoyable experience. They got a lot of laughs out of falling out of the boat with Gregory Gaudet. I've never really fished or crabbed for Dungeness crab, but it did feel like we were watching Deadliest Catch Top Chef style with Gregory and Gabe in the boat. And then you had Dawn and Shota in a boat. They go out and they get these Dungeness crabs and pulling them in. I felt like, Kevin, were you Gregory there where like a little crab gets you on the finger and you just, like, get off of me.
I have a reasonably high pain tolerance, but I remember like there was this great little shtick, a little bit by George Carlin about crabs.
Something else that doesn't look like food. Lobsters and crabs. I mean, anything coming at me walking sideways with big pinchers somehow doesn't make me hungry. In fact, my instinct is step on that fuck. Look at the big bug. Step on the big bug. Before he gets to the children. They look like they mean business.
They're kind of creepy. And again, while I like crab meat, it's just not anything. Again, Tom, I mean, we're back to the beginning of the show. Like, I don't need any marine experiences. Like, I just don't. I don't even like cruises. You're stuck on a boat. Now, I will say we had a really cool experience in Iceland up near the Arctic Circle. Like at dusk, which is 10:30 p.m., we went on like a dolphin watch, and that was cool. That I enjoyed. But nah, man, I don't need to be connecting with no marine life. You know, I don't want to be anywhere
literally
near sharks.
Yeah.
I don't want to like be in a cage with a shark. Like, I don't want any of that. Like, my feeling is we get 30% of the earth. They get 70%. That's an away game. I'm on ground. This is what I want. Now, I like being near the beach. I love being on the beach. I'm a beach bum. Give me a hammock and a beach and a book. I am very happy. But like that, and I like to paddleboard on a lake. But I'm not, marine life is just not for me.
If I hand you a fishing rod, you're just like, yeah, I'm quitting. I'm not into this.
Yeah, I mean, if you hand me a fishing rod, I'm making firewood, except I'm that's what's happening.
Well, I have it in my notes. Crab hunting looks cool as hell. I could deal without the weather. And I think someone at some point said, it's so beautiful out here. And I'm like, I can't see shit. Like, it's fog and it's rain, it's monsooning. It might be beautiful, but I'm not getting any of that from this pouring rain episode. So they get to eat the dish and they're kind of doing that, you know, they do the little sappy like reflection on the season. Gregory's, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm feeling a little stressed, feeling exhausted, but now's the time to push forward, Kevin. It's the finale. Go big or go home. We always get these little pep talks at the end. Do you think those are effective, Kevin, is when the Top Chef alumni comes in and just like gives them the old sage advice? Do you think that helps or do you think that just ramps up the anxiety level?
No, I mean, first of all, as a viewer, we love seeing the Top Chef alums because this is what the show's done so well, is sort of create this family and this diaspora. It's really cool. No, only because I think already, I mean, and it's to the show's credit, when you get down to the final three, you already kind of feel the stress. Like, you know, you worry for them, right? Because there is no, because I mean, let's put it this way. The first half of a season is, if you don't screw up, you're going to be okay. Like, if you're a competent chef and you got 9 contestants, you pretty much know you're not going home unless you completely screw the pooch. You're just not. And I think already I don't need any additional heightened stress because again, I mean, you look around and it's, you know, can I outcook Dawn and Gabe or can I outcook Dawn and Shota? I mean, that's intimidating enough. Like, I mean, the show already sets us up for high stakes. So I don't necessarily need a time, but I also know when you only have 3 contestants, you know, you got to fill 47 minutes and, you know, it's funny. I've noticed that in our prep, we always have a little less to talk about later in the season, even as the stakes get higher, we have less to talk about. Right. So we end up talking about crabs and my aversion to marine life or whatever it is.
All right, Kevin. So they have one hot dish, sorry, a cold dish with 2 hours of prep time and then a hot dish. Right out of the gate, here's the prompt. Dungeness crab, cold dish, hot dish, Who are you picking here as the favorite going into this? I kind of feel like with the sauce profile that we have for Gabe, and he's coming off a quick fire, I thought he was going to come in here and do a really good job. But Shota comes in and says, I'm going to do sushi. And I can't remember the last time we saw sushi on Top Chef. I'm wondering how you're handicapping going into this challenge when it's Dungeness crab, one hot dish, one cold dish. How you felt about that?
Crab is something that gets handled delicately. It's very easy to lose the crabness. It speaks really highly of Dawn and Gabe, who tend to be bolder in their flavors, that they cooked delicious dishes. But I thought this was one sort of made for Shota. There's going to be a dashi, right? Like, what better to work with than crab for that? They're going to be more subtle hints. Like, if you think like ginger, yuzu, which is a citrus, which works beautifully with crustacean. So I felt like this was Shota's to lose, just in terms of the nature of Japanese cooking and his particular technical skill set.
Yeah.
So that was just my sense going in.
But Kevin, this was a trio of forgetfulness, or at least a trio of missing ingredients. I was shocked when we were going into the preview for this episode. There was kind of like, oh, the missing tortilla. Maybe this is obviously going to be great, Gabe, but maybe it's Dawn because she always misses things.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
On this challenge, Kevin, all three chef testants either had a missing component because they forgot it or couldn't get to it, or in the case of Shota, he removed one of the components altogether, which is always a debate on Top Chef, whether you put it on the plate and just live with the results, or you just take it off even though you're promising something and not delivering. This is one of the biggest debates on Top Chef, is whether Shota, when he's preparing his sushi...
Shota, what did you prepare for us?
I prepared crab nigiri with the yuzu kosho aioli. The crab itself is flavored with a little bit of ginger-flavored vinegar.
So it says two ways.
Yeah, it was two ways, but the ume rice wasn't coming out exactly that way I wanted, so I didn't want to put anything that I wasn't comfortable putting on the plate.
So it's only one way?
It's only one way.
Okay.
What did you think about that drama, that development with Shota?
You know, it's a debate, but quite interestingly, generally the chef facing the question just goes ahead and puts it on the plate. Like, you don't see a lot of chefs on the show say, you know, my ume rice had a little too much vinegar. It's not exactly where I want it to be. I'm not going to serve it. Because typically, I think the fear is if they're missing components on the plate, they really dock you. But if I put it on the plate, and just because I'm not entirely cool with it, maybe I can slip it past the chef, you know, the judges. Maybe 4 out of 5 of them get a decent plate, and yeah, this is overcooked. So, I mean, that's the thing, is I agree. It is a debate, and it probably should be a heartier debate. But more times than not, people don't opt for what Shota did, which is basically to say, like, hey, I know I said on the menu two ways. I'm going one way. The ume vinegar is too sharp in my rice for that other piece. It's not going to be what I want. And I mean, it does suggest a certain perfectionism.
Yeah, it does. And I think it worked out for him, because I think that the chefs at the judges table appreciated that he had that kind of foresight to say, like, I'm not going to give you bad food. I'd rather give you one delicious bite or sushi and come up short on the promise rather than giving you something knowing that it doesn't taste good. So I think they appreciated that. In other circumstances, if they were perfect, Gabe and Don, I'm wondering if that's a fatal mistake, is only giving one of the sushi pieces on that plate. But it turns out it wasn't a fatal flaw for Shota.
Let's go through the cold, because I just thought it was a really interesting contrast in who these chefs are. Also, I want a word about Naomi Pomeroy, who was one of the guests at the judges' table. She had a wonderful restaurant that I believe closed during the pandemic called Beast, which you talk about sort of, hey, let's do a cozy restaurant and do kind of a tasting menu. And it's really elevated. It was quite pricey. That was one of my only criticisms of Beast. I had a great meal there during one of my Portland trips. Just lovely. And she's just a wonderful chef in Portland. I think she has something new coming once we get all past all this. But it was really good to see Naomi Pomeroy. I was hoping, you know, we'd see her as one of the Portland chefs around the table. So that was very cool. Tom, three cold dishes. We've talked about Shota sushi one way, which was sushi two ways, and he just, again, this is just Shota at his finest, right? A piece of Dungeness crab. He roasts the shell to get more flavor. A yuzu aioli. A little thing of ginger vinegar. Honestly, Tom, I mean, that's what I want to eat for my last meal.
It sounded so good. It looked so good. They loved it. I think it was Dale who just said, I wanted more. That's always tough, Kevin, when you're at a Japanese sushi table and they just give you one bite and you're just like, can I have just 12 of those things?
But haven't you done that before? Like, yeah. Have a golden eye snapper with this lovely vinegary thing on literally, I think it might have even been ume. And I just asked for let's just bring 4 of those. Yeah. Like, a really good piece of nigiri is man, there's nothing better in the world. Now Gabe goes with a crab and lobster mushroom, which was, first of all, just a really cute concept. The idea that, like, lobster mushroom with crab and lobster, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. He braises it in a crab stock that he makes. And again, this is where sort of all three of these chefs are just so good technically. Does an avocado yogurt as a nod to Sarah. Well, that's not a nod to Sarah, but it's kind of an unintentional nod to Sarah. Get a little yogurt in the final three. And then those aromatic oils that I never know how to make, but I'm dying to learn how to make, because that like translucent green on the plate. Like, I think that's like a basil oil or something. And boy, that looked good, man. That looked like a good. And also, both of us just love mushrooms and lobster mushrooms. First of all, they're so freaky looking. I mean, they literally look like lobsters. And it's just a perfect earthiness to go with the brininess. Like all three of these dishes look great, but Gabe's really was just looked like a winner as well.
I'm here in Louisville, Kentucky right now. I'm trying to go to Edward Lee's restaurant, 610 Magnolia. If I can get a babysitter, maybe we can sneak out for the night. He says the comment that he wants to just take Gabe home with him because he loves this, could not love this dish more. He said, I love Gabe. I want to take him home with me. I really like watching Ed Lee this season. I feel like his commentary has been really delightful, really sharp. I really like to hear him dissect a dish. He loved Gabe's dish.
I could not love this dish anymore. It was delicate and balanced. I love Gabe. I love him. I want to take him home.
I would imagine, though, that transporting a chef against his will across state lines is an interstate crime.
I think it is.
That would be a little weird if he did take him.
And that's a long way to go from Kentucky. I mean, it's that's not a short travel. Hey, maybe that's an Oregon Trail. You know, they go along the Oregon Trail.
The reverse Oregon Trail.
And back is Gabe tied up for Chef Edward Lee. So, yeah, we go with Gabe's soup. Then you got Don coming in with this cold crab salad with a cashew, like, little sauce with pickled mushrooms. Kevin, they seem to love this dish again. But I thought Nina came out, like, a little harsh here, where she just said, Dawn has a very bad habit with whimsical garnishes that don't add anything to the dish. And then Tom just says, yep, you know, if she just did the cashew with the crab, it would have been a great dish, but the garnishes didn't do anything for them. I thought it was part of the presentation. I felt like if you're just doing crab with the cashew sauce or the cashew puree, it's not a very appealing to look at. And I know that's not the show, is to have great presentation, but I do think that's functional what she was doing there with the garnishes.
Pickling sort of been one of the kind of culinary movements of the last few years, and as in present company included, I'm really getting into it as sort of an accompaniment, but it's not a neutral thing, right? Like pickled mushrooms, pickled persimmons, pickled radish, like these aren't neutral bites. Like it is by definition very vinegary. And while it's a lovely additive to some dishes, it might be a distraction to others. And that was sort of my interpretation of what they were saying. You know, you want the richness. Yeah, you feel like you need to balance it. But the problem with balancing richness is if you balance it too much, you kind of lose the richness. And so now you just have this kind of creamy texture without the sort of accompanying richness. And so I kind of got it. It's the old take one thing off before you leave the house. And she doesn't always take one thing off. Frankly, though, the one thing I would object to is, does she have that habit? I don't recall sort of a whimsical distraction in any other. That was the confusion for me, is not that I disagreed with them necessarily. And again, I'm not tasting it, but that I don't recall her doing it that much.
Maybe that's just an editing thing, is that they didn't push that throughout the season. Maybe she was doing that, but Nina's only been around for a few weeks. So, I don't know, but a strong critique there from Nina, and coming out of this one, here's how I scored it. I don't know if you did the scoring, but maybe you can review your notes here. I had Dawn winning this one, Gabe coming in second, and Shota, because he only gave one piece of sushi, I docked him points. Kwame didn't think that was acceptable. And I'm sitting here being like, maybe Shota, do I put him above Gabe here? But given their risk reviews, I have Dawn, Gabe, Shota here.
That's strange, because I had Dawn last for the sole reason that, yes, Gabe got dinged because his was technically not cold. Shota got dinged because he didn't come through with the second piece. But Dawn was the only of the three chefs that got any critique on the actual dish that was served, irrespective of what the parameters of the challenge were. So I actually felt like Gabe kind of won this one, of the three sins, right? This was not exactly cold. You had so many distracting garnishes. And where's the second piece? That the distracting garnishes, like the one that actually affected. In other words, if you were coming in with a veil of ignorance and didn't know the parameters, like Dawn's had the one defect in terms of just culinary composition, right?
True, true.
So that was sort of I kind of had Gabe winning it for having the least, for his transgression being sort of the least severe. That was my take. But I think what we're saying here is it's very close.
super close. I think Richard Blaise said that the cashew crab was inspiring to him. And I kind of just felt like she had, I mean, it's super close, super close. And so coming out of that, I was scoring it like this was a finale, because I think these chefs are just so neck and neck, like whatever is going to send them home. At the time, I'm thinking it's going to be just the slightest of errors. So going into the hot one after this, it might as well just be a tie of those three. But going into the hot dish, they have 1 hour to go. Shota does the braised daikon with the crab dashi or broth, and then Gabe with the crab fat tortillas, the sun chokes, and Dom with the Dungeness crab boil with persimmons and soy and all of these great flavors. Another time where it's just like, these chefs are so good, Kevin. These look so, so good, all of them.
The hot competition was so interesting. And again, what I loved about it was each a real expression of who they were. Like everyone worked to their strengths. There, you know how sometimes when we get down to the end, and, you know, and there are kind of two schools of thought. You know, there's the Kevin Gillespie, like, hey, I'm going to do something I might not have do. Like, what's the point of being here if you're not going to stretch your leg? And then there's the other school, which I don't think is a crutch at all. Which is, I'm here for a reason, like work my strengths. Like, I'm Giannis Antetokounmpo. I'm not going to shoot a three-pointer. Like, I'm going to go into the paint and attack.
Except Giannis does shoot a lot of three-pointers, man.
But I'm saying he is clearly in the Kevin Gillespie school of basketball. Yes. That's my point. So each of these chefs chose the latter, right? Which is, I'm Shota. I'm going to use, like, what's so brilliant about Shota's dish, which was a braised purple daikon and crab stock, this little crab salad on top, tossed in a soy sherry vinaigrette, a little bit of persimmons, is daikon is such a lovely canvas, right? I mean, because it's subtle, because, you know, radishes, yeah, they're, you know, I mean, there's a reason sometimes we're kind of, because like, they don't really do anything. But they do something, which is they provide this canvas for something else in this particular dish in terms of highlighting the crab. You know, I loved what Melissa said because – and you can tell she's sort of tipping her hand a little bit about her style of cooking, which is like he doesn't use butter. He doesn't use chilies. And it wasn't, I don't think, a dig at anybody who does. There's so many different ways to excite diners. But – it is just such a testament to you just kind of just go with the ingredient. Like, you're going to have enough confidence that you're not going to use butter. You're not going to use chilies. You're not going to have the bold flavor. You're going to have the delicate, subtle flavor. And, you know, whether you're reading an author, whether you're looking at a painter, like any art form, subtlety and nuance is a real skill. Not everybody can do that, just as not everybody can be bold. But I just love, as they call it, I think they've used the word restraint, Tom, to describe his cooking.
Yes, he won because of his restraint.
Right, like 10 times this season. And I just think that's really cool. And also what I love, it just kind of captures also the diversity of cooking. And I don't mean demographic or culinary diversity in terms of region, but actually like, hey, there's so many different ways to approach a plate of food.
I found that Shota, what he presented, like you said, was a very Shota dish. And it's amazing how he can bring so much power to his dishes, the flavor, without having that kind of buttery richness or anything like that. He's not throwing in the spice in there. And it just seems like he knows who he is, and he's really good at preparing a beautiful, like aesthetically pleasing dish that just pow. Punches these judges in the face with the flavor and the dynamic profiles within his dishes without having like all of the, you know how you need the fat, you need the spice, you need the acid. Like, he's not hitting every single one of those, and yet they love it. Everything he puts out, it might not be hitting all five of those textures or flavors, and yet he is just nailing it. So yeah, they said, you know, he had the most restraint, which is something that I think can be a negative sometimes, is that you didn't push forward to do something surprising or exciting. But in his case, almost the editing and the fact that he focuses on a couple elements and just wows you with them, they love that. And so then Gabe with the crab fat tortillas, The linen mishap, I don't know whether that was the fatal flaw for him. They didn't really spend too much time saying, can't believe you didn't get everyone a tortilla here. Can you just help me here? Crabs have fat? How does that work?
That was my question, and I'm dying to know the answer to this question. I mean, look, every protein has some fat, right? And I just don't know how you extract the fat, right? Like, yeah. You render a duck, right? It's very clear the fat gets it. You know, when you're putting a steak in, if you're pan searing a steak, you see the fat. Chicken, obviously, schmaltz, you know, there's an entire like wing of Jewish cuisine based on chicken fat. I've never, and you know, salmon even, right? Like, you know, salmon's a fatty fish. You can taste it. And, you know, when you smoke it, you see the oil. I have no idea how you get crab fat. Like, I'm actually dying to know how you extract the fat or how you render crab to create fat. Because I would think, like, if you know, it's a lot of water in there. But this is fascinating to me. And also, I would love to taste what a crab fat tortilla tastes like. Imagine just that beautiful corn, but also with, like, hints of crustacean. That sounds freaking fantastic.
Okay, so I'm looking it up. It's tamale, T-O-M as in Tom, myself, and then alley. Tamale, not to be confused with like other tamale. Crab fat or lobster paste is the soft green substance found in the body cavity of lobsters that fulfills the function of both the liver and the pancreas. And it is considered a delicacy. It may be eaten alone, but it is often added to sauces for flavor and as a thickening agent.
It's that stuff. Yeah, that you kind of look slimy and you're like, you know, but yeah.
In crabs, the tamale is yellow or yellow-green in color. In Maryland, it is the hepatopancreas of the blue crab. It's called the mustard, probably because of the yellow color, which is not the bright yellow of regular prepared yellow mustard, but closer to the one of the brown mustard, such as Dijon, particularly when eating steamed or boiled crabs. It is considered a delicacy. So that's what we're talking here. So a crab fat tortilla is just that yellowy green guts there in a crab that he's basically turning into that tortilla. And then there's the artichoke. I don't know much about the Jerusalem artichoke here. There seemed to be a divisive discussion in the judges table whether that element was a positive or a negative to the dish. What say you on a Jerusalem artichoke? Do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah. So, you know, they're sunchokes. And, you know, it's funny when you see them at the farmer's market, they kind of look like a big stalk of ginger or a thumb of ginger. They are starchy in a way that, like, you've probably had many meals in recent years with a sunchoke puree. So it's kind of a slightly lighter, slightly less, actually I'd say measurably less starchy thing than a potato. So you can kind of do that with. But there's, you know, sometimes they have a smokiness to them. Sometimes they have a bitterness to it. It was interesting to hear someone call them sweet because I never think of that particular characteristic. But it is distinct though, right? Like it's not a natural pairing with a crab. In fact, if you told me one of these three chefs was going to use sunchokes, I would assume it would be Dawn, was part of her boil kind of as an alternate to a potato, kind of just doing a little bit of a, because it does have a very much potato-y profile, but it's just, not in terms of flavor, but just it kind of feels like a texture. In terms of texture, it's like a potato. I would have guessed, oh yeah, that's definitely going to be her, but it does, I mean, it is. The criticism makes sense. I think it's a question of whether you're a Brooke person where you kind of like it or you're a Nina person who felt like, or was it Nina or Naomi?
I think they both did. They both right. Didn't care for it. Too bitter. Oh, Dale. I think Dale and Naomi just did not appreciate that.
Of course, Gabe's going to go with a mole coloradito, which is one of the chocolatier moles. And I love that he used a cram and crab stock. And now, I mean, the sunchokes is kind of in lieu of plantains, which is often used as sort of the thickening agent to that particular mole is plantains. And yeah, it is starchy like a plantain. So I think that was what he was kind of going for. I imagine there are no plantains to be gotten at the Astoria Co-op where they did their shopping. But there were sunchokes, and that is kind of an interesting way to thicken the mole. Because again, you have to the mole has to have that creaminess, but it has to have a certain weight to it, right? It can't just be kind of a thin sauce. I mean, part of it, the heartiness is the texture, and you need some starch to kind of do that. And he chose sunchokes.
Great dish. I think the linen mishap didn't send him home. Let's get to Dawn here, Kevin. How many? She's a cat. She's a cat. She's got 9 lives, Kevin. She's going to use every single one of those lives. She does the Dungeness crab boil and forgets to put the potatoes in. Kevin, is she going to do this every episode? I mean, it was such a good dish. They loved it. It was a little messy. Not a little messy, a lot messy. People were getting hit with shrapnel on the table. All these expensive outfits were getting ruined by this red sauce, and I thought she was going home. Pack your knives. See you, Dawn. You're done. But no, the dish was so good and so flavorful. Yes, they could have used a little spongy biscuit, as Nina said, but not only did she – it was it super messy, and they were okay with that, I guess, in the end. And not only did she forget the potato, but the dish was so fucking tasty, they couldn't send her home.
Yeah, you never know where, like, Padma's going to come down on, because often a critique of hers, particularly Quickfires, it was very difficult to eat.
Yes.
And yet this is the most difficult to eat. But I think there's a certain allowance, because I think it's understood if you're going to a crab royal, you know, put on a bib or you're just going to – you know, there's going to be those wads of newspaper. It's down and dirty. And you would never penalize a chef for capturing the spirit of the thing they're paying homage to. It's a testimonial to how just delicious her food is that, you know, she wasn't docked. Also, what was interesting is I was expecting someone at the table, be it Tom or Dale or someone, to say, you know, traditionally in a crab boil, it's not just the fish. You have the accompaniments. And I don't see any of that here. Right. No one asked for a potato. I mean, though I do think when you talk about it would have been nice to sop it up. Yes, there's bread. But I think one of the things that you love about potatoes in a boil is they get infused with so much of that sauce. And it's this kind of alternate bite. So, you know, you have a big bite of crab or crawfish or whatever it is. And then you have this starchy potato, which is such a contrast in textures and in kind of weight that it does it. But no one seemed to miss that. And it again, it's such a tribute, just what kind of flavor she's able to derive out of her cooking, that this wasn't fatal at all. That basically she put crab in a bowl with a sauce, and that was it. There were no technical wizardry. You know, there wasn't a mole or a stock or, you know, it was just it. And I think it speaks to that. In terms of time management, I don't know what else there is to say. She's got, you know, she's got one more finale left. Again, as I've said, kind of going on, is you don't really ever remember any chefs coming up against time for the finale. One of the privileges of making it to the finale is they just let you cook and they give you plenty of time to do it. In fact, all the artifices that define Top Chef competition, which is, you know, cook blindfolded, go into a dark room, you only have 17 minutes to cook a 40-minute, you know, none of that is on the table. And so my hope for Dawn is that, you know, it ceases to be an issue because it ceases to be an issue. But Tom, there's one thing I do want to talk about. We've put it aside because we've kind of buried the lead here.
Well, this next part is very, very hard. Dawn and Gabe, pack your bags. You're both going to the finale. We could not decide.
How do you feel about the fact that nobody gets sent home? That was a long sigh.
Yeah, I've gone both pro and negative on this. I'm trying to figure out where I fall because this hasn't really happened. We've had three chefs in the finale. Last two seasons of Top Chef, we've had three chefs in the finale. So it's not totally out of the question that we have three chefs on the last episode. Last year, we had the All-Stars with Steph, Melissa, and Brian. The year before that, we had Kelsey, Sarah, and Eric Ajapong. But to me, I was stunned that Dawn didn't get home for the simple reason that you reap what you sow. She's been doing this every week, forgetting to do a dish, and the slightest of errors are going to get you sent home. And she's done an amazing job with the food that she has put on the table. But I kind of felt like it was a little cheap because this is like, there was a flaw. She had a flaw in her dish that she didn't put something out on the plate. And the only thing that I can think of that saved her is that it happened to the other two chefs. And so if you're going to send home Don for forgetting the potato, why can't you send Gabe home for getting melted linen on one of his tortillas that he couldn't put on a plate, or Shota for missing one of the pieces of sushi? So I think her saving grace was the fact that the other two chefs screwed up, and so she didn't get to go home. That's where I stand on here is I think she screwed up again for the same reasons that she always screws up on forgetting to put a component. And they did this whole montage from week one to week 10 and 11. And she doesn't go home. And I kind of feel like I'm excited for them that Dawn is going to have a chance to stay in the competition with Gabe and Shota for the finale. It's not totally out of the ordinary. But I just kind of feel like they're giving her these mulligans time and time again that we've never seen on the show. And I love Dawn. But what are we doing here?
To me, it's not about Dawn. It's not, and I have no preference whether a finale should have two or three chefs. Like I don't care. Whatever the structure is that season is the structure, and it's not about even, you know, Dawn deserves to go home or not. I just feel like, at the risk of being a downer, because I love the dynamic of all three were happy and they get to go on as a group. But your job as the Top Chef jury is to choose. And I know sometimes it's hard. I know it must be excruciating to send a really good chef home when you get to the final three. You know, it is heartbreaking if you do not get to the finale, but you get all the way up there. And here you don't even have the benefit is, yeah, the last 4 weeks are at the coast or 3 weeks are at the coast. There's some, so it's not exactly getting on a plane for Macau. But I just feel like you've abdicated your responsibility as judges. And if the answer is, the jury was deadlocked, we couldn't choose, then you know what? Get back in the kitchen. You've got 45 minutes to make one bite.
Overtime, baby. Yep.
Overtime. And by the way, I don't care if it was Shota. I don't care if it was Gabe. I don't care if it was Dawn. But I just feel like, first of all, I think there is a certain unfairness to it. Shota won. Part of winning is winning. Part of winning is that the next week you show up and there's one fewer competitor you have to extinguish.
I just feel like
they abdicated their responsibility. It was a cop-out. Yes, I know it's hard. I know they've cooked their, they cook their hearts out. I know it feels really powerful and lovely to say, pack your bags, you're both going. But this isn't soccer. Okay. Like there are no ties. You get in the room, and if you got to stay in there for 2 hours, if you've got to, you got to come up with a new scoring system. Like everybody, here's a piece of paper, grade from 100 to zero for each chef. And we're going to average out. And if someone gets a 94.3, they're ahead of 94.2. And that's how we're going to do it. But don't abdicate your responsibilities. Somebody needed to go home.
Yeah. How do you think Jamie feels now where it's like, so when it's really close, then both of you get to go to the finale, like Tom, he does it every time. It's like, this is Top Chef. Unfortunately, one of you has to go home and someone goes home. And on this one, again, I know you're going to say, I don't think Dawn should have gone home, or I'm not here to say whether one of the chefs deserve to go home or not. I'm here to say yes. I'm here to say Dawn deserved to go home. She forgot one of the elements on her dish again, and they've given her a free pass time and time again. And I just feel like if we're going to keep the integrity of the show, Kevin, the integrity of the show, Dawn has to go home.
No, here's where I disagree with you. I'm not saying Dawn shouldn't have been the one to go home. I don't think there's such a thing as a free pass. It wasn't a free pass. Sometimes chefs go home because they forget to put an ingredient. I think it's a tribute to Dawn's cooking that even with these omissions, she never has the worst dish, right? And I think that is sort of the question, is that her cooking has overcome it. Now, in this case, it might have been her, although I do agree that nobody seemed to miss the potato itself. The sweet potato that she didn't get on the plate. I don't know if it's Gabe. I don't know if it's her. Like, I didn't taste the food, right? We're down to the point where, again, both those dishes look great. I don't know. What I'm saying, and look, I think it probably is Dawn. And I have a vested interest because Dawn is on my team to not see her going down. But somebody has to go down. I don't care who it is. You've abdicated your responsibility as a jury by saying, participation trophies for all.
Wow, I love it.
make the call. There are no ties. Get back in the kitchen and we're going to do one bite. Someone makes a crab freaking dessert. I don't know. Go make an amuse. Go make a crab cocktail. It doesn't matter. Hey, who can get the most ounces of crab meat cracked in 10 minutes, you know, and give them both a mallet and whatever the hell. Like, get something. But you can't, on the penultimate week of the show, I cannot abide by, we love you both.
Kevin, let me throw this one at you. Is this Top Chef tipping their hand a little bit that Shota's going to win this whole thing? Because there's no way we're going to have a tie. We're not going to eliminate one of these chefs. And then one of those chefs that didn't get eliminated are going to go on to win the whole thing? No way. There is no way. If that happens, Shota, I'm never coming back to Top Chef Alumni. If I win the penultimate episode, one of the two chefs do not get eliminated, and then one of those two chefs go on to win the whole damn thing over me, I am livid.
I'm with you. So let's give him, what would he should have, should he have a bye in the first half of the finale?
Yeah.
I'm with you.
That's got to be infuriating, is that you, not only did you win the episode, but what if one of those chefs goes on to win the whole thing and they shouldn't have been there in the first place. So spinning this to next episode. Yeah. I think you're right. Is that maybe Shota, maybe the first thing in the episode is like, Shota, by virtue of winning, we need to eliminate either Gabe. This is going to be essentially the overtime.
Yeah. They need some, and I don't think they're going to do it, but, and by the way, typically I like three chefs in the finale. I think there's more to kind of, there's more to see. But again, I think they violated the structural integrity of the show. And I love this season. I love all three of these chefs. That is not the competition. Like, no one said to the San Francisco Giants in 1993, Tom, you won 103 games in the NL West. We're just going to bring you to the playoffs. No, Atlanta had 104. And, you know, the most successful season in Major League history, they didn't get to go to the postseason. No one gave, you know, Will Clark and Barry Bonds a, you know, a pass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Like, it's hard. I know it's hard to get in that room and to, you know, and to eliminate a really just accomplished and talented chef, but them the breaks.
Here is the score by our point system of the last 9 weeks for Shota. 5, 10, 5, 5, 5, 6, 5, 10, 10. He's got 84 points this season compared to Gabe at 67, compared to Don at 57. Look, Shota's never going to say it. I'd be shocked if he says it in the next episode, in the finale, like, what the hell? Like, come on, I have to go against both of these people when I've earned, like, I've been just rolling. The last 8 episodes, I've never been in the bottom. 8 straight, never in the bottom. I got 3 wins in the last 8 episodes, 4 overall. And I got to go against these two. Like, that was cheap. That was not fair.
It was cheap.
He's never going to say that. But man, this guy coming into this finale, he's got to be considered the favorite here.
Tom, any closing thoughts?
I'm glad we touched on the whole no elimination thing. I'm excited to see Don, Gabe, and Shota go to the finale, but I just kind of feel like this is Shota's to win. As we said on the first episode, when you picked him up on the first pick, I was like, yep, that would have been my first pick too. And I'm still sticking to that going into this finale, that Shota, I feel like, is going to run the table and win this whole damn thing. It would be, I'm not going to say a travesty, but it would be a disappointment if Gabe or Don ends up winning this whole thing based on a technicality or an abdication of their duty and not eliminating a chef, Kevin. So I'm glad we covered that as well as we did.
Finale next week. I'm excited for Tom Papastro. This is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.